Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 1st, 2003. Today's session is entitled Poetry Reading, hosted by Marlene Muller and Paula Carlson, number MUM-2003-03. Let's listen in.
I'm happy. In the middle of the ice cream isn't very good.
Well, but if you talk again when we're supposed to be quiet, you're going to have to share your ice cream.
I'll be very quiet.
Yeah. This is a real informal time where we're just going to share some poems that we have and see how it goes, and we'll end after an hour.
This is Marlene and I'm Paula.
Yeah, I'm Marlene and this is Paula. So I'll start with a poem and then Paula will start with a poem. And I want to start with a poem about stargazing, because we went on a star hike last night, and this is about my son when we went out and watched meteors when he was a little boy. And it's called Hope Will Surprise You. Hope will surprise you in a dark, unfamiliar field. You'll be on your back, your eyes wide open, watching for meteors. A slow shower of them will begin. You'll think it's over then, another light will flash above the foothills. Your child in your arms will cry. He'll twist his face away from the unexpected arc. He'll tell you the stars are too close, and even though you will show him the vast band of the Milky Way and explain distance in light years, he will not rest in his smallness. Still, joy will rise in you. Your arms will become sky and fold around you both. His fear will not catch you, and you'll know when to stand and walk home.
Nice.
I'm going to read a poem by Billy Collins, who is our poet laureate in the United States. And I'm reading from a book edited by Garrison Keillor. It's called Good Poems. And Garrison Keillor reads a poem once a day, I believe, on Minnesota Public Radio, the Writer's Almanac. And I say I believe that way because I do not live within reach of Minnesota Public Radio. But I always try to catch it when I'm in reach of Minnesota Public Radio. But I learned today from Patty Rodness that these poems are included every day on the Minnesota Public Radio website. So if you have access to internet, you can every day get the Writer's Almanac poem, even in Bahrain.
I need to have the website.
Yeah, it's probably npr.org would be my guess. But yeah, that's just a guess.
It is on twice in Minnesota.
Yeah, morning and night.
Mm-hmm. Early morning and toward evening.
It is npr.org, and then you put on Writer's Almanac.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. I was delighted to learn that today. This poem is called Nightclub by Billy Collins. You are so beautiful, and I am a fool to be in love with you, is a theme that keeps coming up in songs and poems. There seems to be no room for variation. I have never heard anyone sing, I am so beautiful, and you are a fool to be in love with me. Even though this notion has surely crossed the minds of women and men alike. You are so beautiful, too bad you are a fool. There's another one you don't hear. Or, you are a fool to consider me beautiful. That one you will never hear, guaranteed. For no particular reason this afternoon, I'm listening to Johnny Hartman, whose dark voice can curl around the concepts of love, beauty, and foolishness like no one else's can. It feels like smoke curling up from a cigarette someone left burning on a baby grand piano around 3 o'clock in the morning. Smoke that billows up into the bright lights while out there in the darkness some of the beautiful fools have gathered around little tables to listen. Some with their eyes closed, others leaning forward into the music as if it were holding them up, or twirling the loose ice in the glass, slipping by degrees into a rhythmic dream. Yes, there is all this foolish beauty born beyond midnight that has no desire to go home. Especially now when everyone in the room is watching the large man with the tenor sax that hangs from his neck like a golden fish. He moves forward to the edge of the stage and hands the instrument down to me and nods that I should play. So I put the mouthpiece to my lips and blow into it with all my living breath. We are all so foolish, my long bebop solo begins by saying, so damn foolish we have become beautiful without even knowing it.
Anyone else have a poem they'd like to read? You don't have to stand up as long as you read loudly.
We can keep going here for a while.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Oh, I see a poem, Virginia.
Do you have a good poems book?
I do. The Olsen poem isn't in it.
I think it was in the New Yorker, so I should track that down.
This is called Hanno Pavarotti by a guy named Tony Hoban. I'm driving on the dark highway when the opera singer on the radio opens his great mouth and the whole car plunges down the canyon of his throat. So the night becomes an aria of stars and exit signs as I steer through the galleries of one dilated Italian syllable after another. I love the passages in which the rich flood of the baritone strains out against the walls of the esophagus, and I love the pauses in which I hear the tenor's flesh labor to inhale enough oxygen to take the next plummet up into the chasm of the violins. In part of the song, it sounds as if the singer is being squeezed by an enormous pair of tongs while his head and legs keep kicking. In part of the song, it sounds as if he is standing in the middle of a coliseum, swinging a 300-pound lion by the tail, the empire of gravity conquered by the empire of aerodynamics, the citadel of pride in flames, and the citizens of weakness celebrating their defeat in chorus. Joy and suffering made one at last, joined in everything a marriage is alleged to be. Though I know the woman he is singing for is dead in a foreign language on the stage beside him. Though I know his chainmail is made of silver-painted plastic and his mismanagement of money is legendary, as I know I have squandered most of my own life in a haze of trivial distractions and that I will continue to waste it. But wherever I was going, I don't care anymore, because no place I could arrive at is good enough for this thing made out of experience, but to which experience will never measure up. And that dark and soaring fact is enough to make me renounce the whole world or fall in love with it forever.
Anyone else?
I'll read a poem by Jane Kenyon, who's one of my favorite poets. It's called Let Evening Come. It just seems like a good poem for this time of the day. Let the light of late afternoon shine through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the crickets take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to air in the lung, let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless, so let evening come.
Writings about the same 10 minutes. It was
Tuesday, April 19th. I believe it was 2001. At 10 minutes to 6 in the evening, whatever your time was. And this is a poem that was written for that, that project. At the Fish House. In this blue evening, daylight has overtaken darkness at last for control of the sky. Tulips clink like wine goblets in the wind, and apple blossoms scatter over the sidewalks of Sydney, British Columbia, as though a wedding couple had just slipped out of sight. At the Fish House on Fifth Street, across from the bank, whose windows glint like silver in the sun, we wait for fish, battered and fried. Crates of potatoes stack head high behind the door. Goldfish fan the expanse of their blown glass bowl. Guppies litter the blender. Behind the counter, our fish come up popping and snapping, land in a nest of newspaper where the cook wraps them snugly in news of the world. We receive our packages one by one, girl child, boy child, woman, man. We open the world to eat our fish. On a ship near Africa's coast, children dream of fish. Inside a fence in Quebec City, the powerful sit at tables elegant with fish. We break fish and eat, reading the news, as shopkeepers lock their doors and Sydney curls up like a cat for the night, still bright as day. We lick our fingers, linked by this hunger, this dreaming, this spinning earth.
Another poem that's about time, and Roseanne doesn't know I'm going to ask her this, but will you help me read it? It's not that hard to figure out. Just come up and off. It's a bunch. It's a poem maybe some of you heard about. It's a few years ago.
Does anyone need glasses?
Oh, God. I don't actually care. About a
not that old, is it?
That's for Aaron.
A plane wreck that happened in the Cascades a few years ago when they found the body of the man that was the pilot. He had survived the crash and had written down the hours as they passed. So this is a poem from that newspaper article, and it's called The Hours. And so, Roseanne, it's interspersed with a scripture from Psalm 19. So you read the scripture part, okay? And I'll read the text, scripture text.
Okay.
The hours. After his plane went down in the mountains and he survived,
the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands.
He wrote on his hand the hours as they passed.
Day after day they poured forth speech. Night after night they displayed knowledge.
Later, when his wife leaned over the body they'd recover.
There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard.
She read that at noon he loved her.
Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world.
He didn't record the scarred brown slope, the bruise where the plane slammed and skidded.
In the heavens, he has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion.
He wrote that he hoped they would find him soon, and at 3 o'clock, can't see.
It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat.
Others?
A little change of pace. This is a poem by Robert Service, and some of you are familiar with Cremation of Sam McGee, but he has some others that are sort of interesting, and this one I think fits with Holden's bio. It's called Dirt. Dirt is just a matter out of place, so scientists aver. But when I see a miner's face, I wonder if they err. For grit and grime and grease may be, in God's constructive plan, a symbol of nobility, the measure of a man. There's naught so clean as honest dirt, so of its worth I sing, I value more an oily shirt than garment of a king. There's naught so proud as honest sweat, and though it stink, we cuss. We kid glove chaps are in the debt of those who sweat for us. It's dirt and sweat that makes us folks proud as we are today. We owe our wealth to weary blokes befouled by soot and clay. And where you see a belly fat, a dozen more are lean, by God, I'd sooner doff my hat to washerwife than queen. So here's a song to dirt and sweat, a grace to grit and grime, a hail to workers who beget the wonders of our time. And as they gaze, though better girt, the palaces in sky, let them believe by sweat and dirt they too are glorified.
One here called From Blossoms by Lee Young Lee. From blossoms comes this brown paper bag of peaches we brought from the boy at the bend in the road where we turned towards signs painted peaches. From laden boughs, from hands, from sweet fellowship in the bins comes nectar at the roadside. Succulent peaches we devour, dusty skin and all, comes the familiar dust of summer. Dust we eat. Oh, to take what we love inside, to carry within us an orchard, to eat not only the skin, but the shade, not only the sugar, but the days, to hold the fruit in our hands, adore it, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background, from joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom, to impossible blossom, to sweet, impossible blossom.
Other poem? I have a single poem that we live in Western Washington, and I'm particularly in mind with this poem I knew as a child. I'm trying to remember because I don't have room back. And it goes, and to the flowers so beautiful, the father gave a name. Back came a little blue-eyed one, all timidly it came. And standing at its father's feet, and gazing in his face, he said in low and trembling tones, and with a modest grace, dear God, the name thou gavest me, alas, I have forgot. Kindly the father looked him down and said,
forget me. Sweet. Yeah, it is. I love it. We have so many forget me nots around. Other poem? I have a fun one here about someone named Vassar Miller, whom I hadn't heard about before. It's called Morning Person. God, best at making in the morning, tossed stars and planets singing and dancing, rolled Saturn's rings spinning and humming, twirled the earth so hard it coughed and spat the moon up, brilliant bubble floating around it for good, stretched holy hands till birds and nervous sparks flew forth from them, and beasts, lizards, big and little, apes, lions, elephants, dogs and cats cavorting, tumbling over themselves, dizzy with joy, when God made us in the morning too, both man and woman, leaving Adam no time for sleep, so nimbly was Eve bouncing out of his side, until as night came everything and everybody, growing tired, declined, sat down in one soft, descended hallelujah. I read this poem to someone who pointed out to me, though, that actually God must have created in the dark, because let there be light, and then there was light, so the actual creation happened in the dark. This was a night person, not a morning person. I thought that was kind of a fun one.
Well, here's one that's kind of pathetic. It's sort of fun, but it's very pathetic. That I wrote, it was called Hermit Failure. Because have you ever gone on a retreat and you're supposed to be really religious and spiritual, it doesn't work?
No.
one of those straw bale houses, you know, where you go in and you're supposed to be really religious in them? Hermit failure. Walk uphill on gravel path to straw bale hermitage. Read sign on door to remove shoes. Enter. Remove shoes. Read note to leave room as found. To smooth futon quilt and extinguish all candles. Read cover of Merton's book. Read small card advising one to read operating procedures prior to using stove. Sit on cushioned built-in oak seat and push window open. Notice rustling, feathered canopy, and eucalyptus growth. Struggle to notice something more. Shut window. Rise. Accept act of opening window as prayer. Step back into shoes. Check if door unlocked for next person. Close. Turn. Leave.
I thought maybe I'd go way back and recite for you the first 18 lines of the Canterbury Tales. And if any of you memorize those in school, let's do it together. For old time's sake. They told me when I memorized this would come in handy at cocktail parties. I believe I have yet to go to a cocktail party. But in any case,
we could bring some in.
We could get cocktails. Everybody does wine and cheese. Nobody does cocktails. But let's go. It starts Wandat Ap Ryl, if you recall. So here we go. Wandat Ap Ryl, with your shuras sota, the drocht of Mars hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in sweet liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the poor. Wan Zephyrus ache with his sweet brenda, his spirit hath in every holt and hetha the tender acropus, and the youngest sonna hath in Aram his habo course urona, and small of foolus mock and melodia that slape in all the niche with open ear, so pricketh him natur in your courages. Than long and folk to go on pilgrimages, and Palmer is for to sake astrongest. From Ferna Hall was Cuth in Sombri Londis, and specially from every Shira's enda of Engelond, to Canterbury they renda, the holy blissful martyr for to Seca, that him hath hopen one that they were Seca. We came almost to the end.
Right.
Gotta get those last three lines down.
I have a bit of a poetic response to that. For all of us who are silent for that poem, this is Billy Collins again, and this poem is called Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if one by one the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps. The address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue. Not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark, mythological river whose name begins with an L. Well, on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
That's a good one.
Well,
Entirely two of them.
It's not in nine persons. It's in this big old ceiling around the room.
Well, since we're kind of on the topic of authors, there's a, this is a kind of clever book. And in the bookstore, there's a book by Denise Levertov called The Stream and the Sapphire, and it's poems on religious themes, which I recommend. They're not real long poems, and they're not too hard to understand. And not getting us too far away from my favorite topic, which is death. I'll return us back to this poem. I used to work for this author, a privilege of many secretaries, a long line of them. And this poem's called Working for You. And I worked for Denise Levertov up until she died in 1997. So, Working for You. I miss you standing in your bathrobe, handing me a new poem to type. I miss typing it neatly without error. I miss feeling in my arms your rhythm and line. I miss the sun moving across the desk, brightening the room I was afraid to make a mistake in. I miss the chance of telling you I liked your poem. I miss you swiveling your chair toward only me and hearing without earning it your thoughts. I miss you telling me again what I only once forgot to make 3 to 5 copies. I miss the creak of the stairs under your feet, the sun filling now the whole wall of window. Time alone to reread what you wrote, pay the milkman, write a list of errands, gather up the mail, call from the door, goodbye, I'll be back to you, dressing in your bedroom. I miss driving through weather and seasons, my company or riding on the seat beside me. I miss waiting in lines and you paying me to wait. Some days I took longer than I needed and drove to the water. I miss searching the lake for what I wanted. I miss coming back.
Can you tolerate another honor service?
Sure.
This one's called Inspiration. How often have I started out with no thought in my noodle and wandered here and there about where fancy bade me trudle, till feeling farm-like in my glee, I voiced some gay distiches, returning joyfully to tea a poem in my breeches. Squatting on a rimy slope with vast of sky about me, I scribbled on an envelope the rhymes the hills would shout me, the couplets that the tree would call, the lays the breezes proffered, and oh no, I didn't think at all, I took what nature offered. For that's the way you ought to write, without a trace of trouble, be supercharged with high delight, and let the words outbubble. Be voice of vale and wood and stream, without design or proem, then rouse from out a golden dream to find you've made a poem. So I'll go forth with mind a blank, and sea and sky will spell me. And lolling on a rimy bank, I'll take down what they tell me. As Mother Nature speaks to me, her words I'll gaily docket. So I'll come singing home to tea, a poem in my pocket.
Others?
Since Ben read the poem, it's the poem I usually read. No, I haven't. But one of the things that I love are the number of poets, poet wannabes that come through Hobart. And one of them, Anne Niedringhaus, has become a friend, and she has just published her first chapbook. And she's been published in several places. And this is a poem, I believe that Anne has been married about 35 years. And this is a poem that she wrote for their anniversary. And it's called Marriage. I remember the day I first decided not to guard myself against you. We have shared brief storms that blew us to our separate wailing walls. With time and seeing the world, we've learned the small scale of our suffering. But there is no size in pain. There is the official story. Even we have admired its shiny, impenetrable veneer. I was taught I should pour myself into you, but you didn't want to be force-fed like grass, pumped artificially full of fertilizers, till you'd end the season congested and sluggish, unnaturally green from my ministrations. Our argument, abandoned, remains there, as if we'd thrown a tablecloth over an already set table. We do not tend a garden plot carefully planned, no black plastic to block weed seeds, just soil open to the sky.
What else did you memorize?
Actually, when you were reading your poem, I thought of a story. A friend of my husband's and my told us one. He's a professional musician, and he's probably, I suppose, 40 or something. But when he was about 10, he was taken to a performance at the Philadelphia Orchestra. And someone he went with knew someone who was in the orchestra, so he got to go backstage and meet the musicians. And he was studying, he's an organist and vocal conductor now, and I don't know what he was studying at the time, 10 years old, piano lessons probably. And he got backstage and met this famous musician who shook his hand and said, "Well, would you like to be a musician when you grow up?" And he said, the boy said, "I am a musician." I think that's a wonderful story for a little 10-year-old to say. And I've been encouraged by Laurie Johnson to draw this week, which is a new venture for me. And I always am very encouraged when people write poems and share poems. And even though we may not be published poets and poet laureates like Billy Collins, still I think we have an art to offer. With that encouragement, any poems out there?
Spontaneous poetry.
You do one line out of the next.
Yeah.
Well, there's a woman in Minnesota whose name is Joyce Sutphin, and I've enjoyed hearing her poems read, and none of those that I particularly enjoyed is in Garrison Keillor's book there, but there is one on page 163 about a young girl on a tractor, and so we'll have a rural flavor here. Girl on a tractor, she calls it. She teaches, I think, at Gustavus Adolphus, at least she has at some time. I knew the names of all the cows before I knew my alphabet. But no matter the subject, I had mastery of it. And when it came time to help in the fields, I learned to drive a tractor at just the right speed so that two men walking on either side of the moving wagon could each lift a bale, walk towards the steadily arriving platform, and simultaneously hoist the hay onto the rack, walk to the next bale, lift, turn, and find me there, exactly where I should be, my hand on the throttle, carefully measuring out the pace. And she apparently grew up on a farm near St. Peter, Minnesota, and writes, I think, beautifully about rural life. I've heard poems that she has written on other subjects also, but the ones about her, I suppose, childhood in the country have resonated with me. Not that I spent my childhood in the country either, but I just have enjoyed them.
I'd be willing to pass this book to anyone else, too. Yeah. Have a look if you'd like to read.
Can you see a hand over here, but it could be a hand.
I have a poem with an African flavor. This is called Uprising. A boy, long and thin as wire, but still boy, his mother must despair what to feed him. I and my mother mind return to this. Flashes sudden as traffic lights the soles of his feet, passing in the sand after his cows, all sinew, bone, and fringe of hide. His shirts flapping furious as startled wings. I have seen not one bird in Angola, I remind my other self,
That one who's got her mind made up, she'll have beauty, nothing less. All the while, the lead cow's bell, made from some poor metal, clapper of wood, rings like a soloist rising above the choir, rich, full, and round. I just knew it had struck her like a truth, like memory, the way it faded, leaving only the soft, cloven caverns in the sand to assure us it had really happened, when, in perpendicular rush, a gaggle of children, who'd earlier dodged traffic and roadside pyramids of fruit for stray wire, had wrapped fist-sized wheels, stretched up a push handle, miraculous, I'll have to give her this. Between each pair of dervishly whirling hose, a bird, feathered in scraps of cloth from the floor of the seamstress hut, flapped wings, elegant in length, blue, orange, crash of red, black, green. The bevy of them, screeching and cawing, swarmed us, and, chased by the clattering boys, almost took flight.
I have a short poem about a seamstress. That's kind of nice there. Holden is encouraging of using inclusive language, and this is a poem that reminds me that God could be a female like the seamstress that I went to with was female. And it's called Alteration. The seamstress gathers sorrow in the folds of the black dress. Her steady fingers press against the hollow of my back, and gently she cinches and lifts the linen from my skin. In silence, she marks my life with chalk and divides love into patterns I can follow, pieces that fit. I believe I could stand here forever, finally perfect and still. But now she is kneeling beside me. When she asks me simply to turn, I do. Any other sewing poems?
Well, there's one in Billy Collins on dressing Emily Dickinson.
Oh, my!
Yeah.
You
think of that? I've read this one out loud before, so.
What a guy.
Do you want to read this
one? I was just going to read the Gracian Rendell poem that your poem brought to mind. It won't take long while Christina's looking up undressing Emily Dickinson. It'll keep us all here for this poem while we're waiting. Where do I have this?
While you're looking, can I pass my popcorn around and can people help me eat it up?
This poem is by Gracia Grendel called Getting It Straight, and it's an interpretation of part of Luke 15, is it, that has the prodigal and the ten lost sheep and the lost coins in it? So there's no punctuation here, and you've got to listen hard for the different voices coming up, but I think you'll pick it up. Getting it straight. What woman, Lord, are you making God a woman? What woman having 10 pieces of silver? This is about Judas. Didn't he sell Jesus short for pieces of silver? No, it's 10 pieces, and losing one, would not she light a candle? Oh, I get it. This is about those virgins, the gals without oil. Foolish of them, I'd say. But what with the oil shortage, we could all be darkness. She swept the house like Dad after lunch. Let's get this straight. What is this stuff about? About Dad. He does not mind sweeping the floor with a damp towel under the broom. She searched diligently and found it. He does it for love. What woman, on finding the coin, will not call her neighbors? I get it. This is about Ma Bell. No, Mother. This is about God, who says, rejoice with me. Rejoice. what is lost is found. You're talking about God. Yes, she says, I have found what was lost. Rejoice with me, rejoice.
That's good.
This one doesn't want to read yet.
Well, I'll give it a try. It, we got the title wrong, though. It's really called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes. First, her tippet, made of tulle, easily lifted off her shoulders and laid on the back of a wooden chair. And her bonnet, the bow undone with a light forward pull. Then the long white dress, a more complicated matter with mother-of-pearl buttons down the back, so tiny and numerous that it takes forever before my hands can part the fabric like a swimmer's dividing water and slip inside. You will want to know that she was standing by an open window in an upstairs bedroom, motionless, a little wide-eyed, looking out at the orchard below, the white dress puddled at her feet on the wide board hardwood floor. The complexity of women's undergarments in 19th century America is not to be waved off. And I proceeded like a polar explorer through clips, clasps, and moorings, catches, straps, and whalebone stays, sailing toward the iceberg of her nakedness. Later, I wrote in a notebook, it was like riding a swan into the night. But of course, I cannot tell you everything. The way she closed her eyes to the orchard, how her hair tumbled free of its pins, how there were sudden dashes whenever we spoke. What I can tell you is, it was terribly quiet in Amherst that Sabbath afternoon. Nothing but a carriage passing the house, a fly buzzing in a window pane. So I could plainly hear her inhale when I undid the very top hook and eye fastener of her corset. And I could hear her sigh when finally it was unloosed, the way some readers sigh when they realize that hope has feathers, that reason is a plank, that life is a loaded gun that looks right at you with a yellow eye.
Hmm. There are all these allusions to her own poems.
Yeah. Yeah.
This poem, and I don't know if you've read her poems, but they're full of dashes, and that's just funny.
And she's notorious for standing by that window, right?
Yeah.
And that poem about the carriage by Catherine, one of the most famous ones.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, that is a thing with feathers.
You would have hit. Stop for death, but death kindly stopped for
yes.
me. Her pot of fly buzz when I died. Mm-hmm. Lots of poems.
It's a great poem, though.
Yeah.
But a guy should read it.
I have one here on a much tamer subject. It's called Happiness by Raymond Carver. And it goes like this. So early, it's still almost dark out. I'm near the window with coffee, the usual early morning stuff that passes for thought, when I see this boy and his friend walking up the road to deliver the newspaper. They wear caps and sweaters, and one boy has a bag over his shoulder. They are so happy they aren't saying anything, these boys. I think if they could, they would take each other's arm. It's early in the morning, and they are doing this thing together. They come on slowly. The sky is taking on light, though the moon still hangs pale over the water. Such beauty that for a minute, death and ambition, even love doesn't enter into this. Happiness, it comes on unexpectedly and goes beyond, really, any early morning talk about it. Yeah.
Gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other tomorrow.
Yes.
I have an anti-nature poem.
Great for all.
Well, I was reading all these great poems about nature, and I thought, you know, I grew up right by a river, the Willamette River. Why didn't I ever write a cool nature poem or be a nature poet or something? So anyway, this is my anti-nature poem. It's called Bridge. The river didn't offer flocks of birds or wood ducks nesting near shore. I never startled from a flick of light on water, the flash of fin and silver tail. The current didn't care I was growing up. It sent a boy who slowed his car by the old ice house. He drove beside me as I rode across the wooden bridge. He asked from his open window if I liked my bike seat. He smiled and asked if I liked how the bike seat felt. There were dirty circles high around the cottonwood trunks, lines the spring flood left behind. Typhoid serum ran up my veins. Its heat and aching weight, I wrestled all night. I want to have known the river clear, the park unforbidden, its gravel beach unlit by headlights, awash instead in early dusk, the sun after supper lowering itself over cedar and fir. That's not completely empty.
Farmers these days to go out in their fields and their old farmhouses there. People haven't lived in for a long time and they consider them sort of grand justice, so they're burning them down. And it's this death of a yellow grass farmhouse. The house burns skin first, curling paint, roof shingles, combustible as hair. Then the inner delicate wallpaper, thin as the underside of a wrist. Good Saskatchewan snow grips the floor, snow the crop in the fields, a windless, rare day. Now see how the floor succumbs, the way the last vestiges of that painted-on floral design, meant to serve for a rug, flares first, as though a ring of choristers stood facing each other in order to blend the colors of their song. On what furniture remains, the farmer, ears dead, sits hunched, hands clenched, eternally weary. She, whose domain once was house, rushes through rooms wringing her hands, desperate to salvage the nothing that can be saved. Yet, from children to shoes, such was her habit, her must of being. And now the bones of the house stand alone, washed in great light, and at last, clean as wind, as sky, but for this wound in earth, which, in a few months' time, will lie under wheat, and the wheat, golden at summer's end, will rattle their weighty heads, bend and dance.
We burned down our great-grandparents' house on the farm, and it's exactly how the wallpaper goes. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Who wrote that? I didn't hear that.
She did.
She did.
She did.
This person.
Oh!
A poet?
Yeah. Well, now we know that.
It's your turn, Paula.
Well, as I say, this book, I could go on here quite a while, so maybe I'll find one here to close with. This is a poem by Robert Bly, and it's called For My Son Noah, 10 Years Old. Night and day arrive, and day after day goes by. And what is old remains old, and what is young remains young, and grows old. And the lumber pile does not grow younger, nor the weathered tubercores lose their darkness. But the old tree goes on, The barn stands without help so many years, the advocate of darkness and night is not lost. The horse swings round on one leg, steps and turns. The chicken flapping claws onto the roost, its wings whelping and walloping. But what is primitive is not to be shot out into the night in the dark. And slowly the kind man comes closer, loses his rage, sits down at the table. So I am proud only of those days that we pass in undivided tenderness, when you sit drawing or making books stapled with messages to the world, or coloring a man with fire coming out of his hair. Or we sit at a table with small tea carefully poured, and so we pass our time together, calm and delighted.
Oh,
sure.
Like, Denise Levitov. Oh, wait, we have several endings.
Yeah.
This is called Primary Wonder. One of my favorites. Days pass when I forget the mystery. Problems insoluble and problems offering their own ignored solutions jostle for my attention. They crowd at the antechamber, along with a host of diversions, my courtiers wearing their colored caps, clothes, and bells. And then, once more, the quiet mystery is present to me. The throng's clamor recedes. The mystery that there is anything, anything at all, let alone cosmos, joy, memory, everything, rather than void. And that, O Lord, Creator, Hallowed One, you still, hour by hour, sustain it. Other endings?
I would just really like to invite you into a meeting. I don't know your name, but I see you are sitting really with a little book of your own there, and I love the two poems that you wrote. You've got another favorite of yours.
Drew, would you mind if I read the piano, Sam? You wait for it? Okay. At the piano exam. He is African sun in his kente cloth shirt and shorts, and loud as a marketplace, taxis and bicycles competing on the street, stacks of tomatoes, dust circling the feet, all crumpled into one chair, waiting his turn, face red from the heat of it all. The woman in charge lifts her index finger constantly to her lips, warns the librarian of exams. Kente cloth clamors, refusing to quiet itself. The door opens, and the boy, clutching his music, shuffles his seven-year-old cheeks, jolt of bicycle bell and clink of bottles into the exam room. Marketplace muffles at the closing of the door. The librarian tips her half glasses, tells me I'm not allowed pressing my ear to the door, so I go outside where the air is a child let out of school and the windows hang open like tired eyelids. The boy collects notes loosened and surprised as fish gathered into nets, then lays them out in arpeggios in scales like school children lined up at the start of the day, everyone in uniform. At last, the door opens, horns honk, a woman grills plantains, tailors hunch over their machines. The boy emerges, cracked grin, thumb pointed toward the sky.
E.E. Cummings has a great way of turning words around. And I don't know the whole of this poem, but it's a great last line, if indeed we are going to close, which is, I thank thee, Lord, for most this amazing day. Mm-hmm. And then goes on, to recite the things for which she is thankful, also mixing up the word orders that, to the point where I would hesitate to read the whole thing out loud anyway. But that first line has really grabbed my attention. I thank thee, Lord, for most this amazing day.
Amen.